Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Harry Sewell, who is the Director of HS Consultancy Associates, specialists in mental health, equalities, social care and working across the NHS. He's a social worker by background with over 20 years experience. He's held a number of senior roles with social care and the NHS, most recently as Executive Director on Organisational Development in an Intercity Mental Health Foundation Trust. He's the author of several books, two of which are Working with Ethnicity, Race and Culture in Mental Health and the Equality Act 2010 in Mental Health. He was also Director of Substance Misuse Services and Director of Social Care, as well as leading the Race Equality Program for the National Mental Health Development. Through these roles, Harry has worked to improve service provisions for groups with protected characteristics as defined within the Equality Act 2010. He has used his positions to advance this agenda and has earned a reputation nationally and internationally for this work. He's going to talk to us today about race, racialization and interrelatedness and how all this might relate to the Middle Way. Hello, Harry. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hello, Barry. Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, could you begin, Harry, by telling us maybe a bit about your background and what drew you to the work you do?
Right. Well, my first foray into this kind of subject was when I was at college at Bulmersh. It was Reading University just coming anyway, Bulmersh College. And we were on the social work course there and we noticed an absence of much material on race and race inequality.
Yeah.
And I volunteered to our course tutor, a wonderful chap called Doug Badger, and said, look, you know, I'm quite happy to make some input to the session. So I had to do a bit of reading around the subject. And that was the first time I kind of moved from just kind of feeling a kind of passion for the agenda to having to formalize my thoughts in order to present them. So that was back in the early 90s. Well, yeah. The late 80s, actually, it was in my first year, so that would have been in 89.
Okay. Was that a significant influence in you actually becoming a social worker?
Well, funnily enough, what made me become a social worker was other people seeing that I had a particular affinity for working with others, and that the thing that drove me was about the connectedness with other people. And there's a story I remember from being a child. I grew up in Jamaica. There was an albino girl in our class, you know, a child who had white appearance, but had the physical features of being a black girl.
Yeah.
And because she was different, a lot of people scorned her. And, you know, if she wanted to borrow something, people would shove it across the desk. And, you know, I remember saying, look, I'm quite happy to sit beside her and, you know, here's my eraser if you want to use it. And I was quite happy to interact with her. And it was really countercultural to what was happening in the class at the time. And I was very young, but that was the kind of first memory I have of going against the trend.
Yeah.
Of saying, you know, there was something in me that stood up for social justice, I guess, from a really early age and was prepared to kind of act in ways that might have been in kind of detrimental. But for me, that girl being isolated in that way was unacceptable.
Sure. And where do you think you got that from? Do you think your mum and dad played a part?
Yeah. I mean, in the foreword to my first book, you know, I say, you know, to Hazel and Lorenzo, you're the answer to the question most people ask of me. And that's because, you know, people often say, you know, how come you're so motivated? How come you got to where you are? You know, why are you as you are? And it's largely because of my folks. I mean, they are amazing people. You know, everyone in life, you know, has good, they've got bad. But my parents are truly deeply amazing people. And I feel that kind of rubbed off.
Okay, so should we get started then? So what do you understand by the term race, Harry?
Wow. Race for me is a combination of some kind of physical characteristic that lead others to then ascribe a whole raft of other attributes based on these physical characteristics. And it is that process of ascribing the characteristics that defines race. So for me, race is very little to do with the kind of real physical appearance, the kind of genetic composition of an individual. For me, race is more to do with social stratification, is to do with the way in which others will see another and place them into a category.
Okay, yeah. Well, one of the preoccupations of the Middle Way Society is the avoidance of absolutes. Now, our practice is directed towards recognition of what might be absolute, and could race, or, you know, more specifically in our own context, in the UK, for example, be whiteness? Could whiteness be one of them?
Well, yes. I mean, the kind of interesting fact about what people consider to be race is that very, very few people can trace an ancestry back to a single source that is linked with the way they see themselves racially.
Yeah.
So Scott Plous, in one of his books, says, you know, 75% of African American men have white ancestry. And, you know, that's kind of true for all of us, is that we're kind of, you know, very mixed. People would see me and see me as a black man and wouldn't really realize that I have a significant Syrian lineage. And that's just not apparent. And therefore, the idea that someone could define me as being black or being African holds up only as a social construct and not as a biological fact. And I kind of think that's true for whiteness.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, I find all this stuff fascinating. You know, apparently we all share a common ancestor from Africa only about 70,000 years ago, that we're all Africans. And also, if you actually look at how people around the world are different, we're virtually identical genetically. I think it's only 0.1% that is different, and that difference is to do with things like maybe skin pigmentation, or like, for example, white Westerners, they are more resistant to something like dairy or something like that. But in terms of intelligence or anything like that, there is no evidence whatsoever there's any difference at all.
No, that's absolutely right. And yes, the kind of scientific significance of race is almost negligible when you compare that with the social significance of race. And people continue to search for real profound reasons, genetically and scientifically, for difference. And it will never in any way compare with what happens in normal social interactions. Because, you know, so my field is in mental health, and race plays such a significant role in the experience of people in the mental health system. Now, there is nothing in day-to-day treatment that relates to a kind of physical test where people would say, well, okay, you're from, you know, this particular racial group, so therefore it means we need to adjust the treatment in this particular way. That doesn't happen. But yet still, race is so predominant in the field of mental health. And that's largely to do with the kind of socioeconomic factors and kind of interpersonal factors, as opposed to something biological. So the privilege that we give to race as a scientific construct is really an error.
Mm-hmm. So, well, we'll move on later about how we can sort of work against this. But let's move on to the next term, racialization. This is actually a new term for me, Harry. I'd be interested to hear what that means. It sounds like a process in some way. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, this allows me to answer some of the previous question about what race is, because an easy way for me to illustrate this point is if I were to say to any group of social scientists, you know, let's discuss race and mental health, let's discuss race and housing, race and education. There's already a formula in our minds about what we mean. We wouldn't be kind of thinking about, okay, let's discuss the experience of white students in education. Immediately we start to kind of think about, you know, what's the experience of ethnic minorities in education or in the health system? And we therefore link race with the idea of the other and difference. So it's almost as though white isn't a race as such. So the term ethnic minorities is also kind of linked with this idea that you've got other people who have an ethnicity, other people who have a race, and we just are. So the process of racialization is the conferring onto another the idea that they belong to a particular race. And in doing so, two things happen. One is that there's a process of stratification, a kind of hierarchy.
Yeah.
So, you know, race often kind of be like difference means deficient. And then the second bit of the process is that the person who's described as other comes to embrace that concept of being other and almost begins to act within the kind of boundaries set by saying you don't belong, this is the kind of person or the kind of group you are.
Yeah.
So the process serves to separate rather than to bring together people.
Wasn't there quite a famous experiment? I can't remember the name of the sociologist that did it, but they got these young kids to choose white and black dolls, and they were doing it with young black children in the United States, and more often than not, the black children were choosing the white doll as a preferential one because of this reinforcement you're talking about.
No, absolutely. And you know, I remember a little while back when Michael Jackson first started to go white, I'll put it like that, and one of my colleagues, Malcolm Phillips, said, you know, look, yes, there is something bizarre about it, but on another level, what he's saying is all the power, the ideas of beauty, acceptance, the privilege, is all kind of wrapped up with being white. And if you can purchase that, then kind of why not? In the same way that, you know, people who are getting older and kind of, you know, they want to get acting parts, and they think, well, wrinkles don't get you acting parts predominantly, you know, smooth, youthful looking face does. So if I can kind of buy my way into youthfulness, I'll buy my way into it.
Yeah.
And it's not kind of frowned upon. And yeah, so all around the world, we find these replications of this idea that whiteness represents privilege. And it's frowned upon without, I think, enough analysis of why it is. For example, at the moment, there's an explosion in bleaching creams across the so-called black world. And you know, people are sometimes going through very painful processes trying to bleach their skin lighter because they associate lightness or whiteness with privilege, because the reality is there is privilege with being white.
You're associated with the term microaggression, a prominent experience of non-white people in the hands of white people. Could you perhaps speak from your own experience of what that means?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, microaggressions was a term coined by a guy called Chester Pierce. And, you know, I've got to kind of acknowledge, you know, him being at the forefront of this way of thinking. And, you know, there's quite a funny anecdote I really like to tell about some of my experiences. I was at a festival, Women's Festival, a very long time ago with my sons. One's quite tall and has got dreadlocks. Well, he was the only one at the time who had dreads. The other one has as well. And we were standing outside our tent, and a young white man came up and said, yo, do you know I can get some weed? And I said to him, well, like, you know, we don't smoke, never have, but if you walk a bit further up this lane, you might find another group of black guys you can ask. And he said, oh, no, it wasn't about that. I'm not being funny. And I thought, yeah, kind of interesting. And the point of that story is that for all of us, me and my sons, they're grown up, it was an experience that we've had several times.
Yeah.
And our life is littered with people not really intending to be racist or nasty or unpleasant, but there are these kind of little reminders that we see you in a particular way, that the external world sees me in a particular way. And one of the consequences of that is that if I go into a conference or someone invites me to a party and I'm the only black person or one of, you know, two or three, I'm very conscious that I'm seen as being different, not because I've got a chip on my shoulder or because, you know, there's something about the way I think about things. It's because the constant experiences I have of people reinforcing to me that I'm different. You know, I could kind of give you as you can imagine, innumerable number of episodes where people have inadvertently pointed out that I'm different. You know, when I was a very senior manager in the NHS years ago, people would say, oh, you speak very well. And I wish to say under my breath, for a black man, because that's the implication.
Yeah.
Or, you know, people would walk into the room and they'd look around and say, oh, you're the director. I was kind of expecting someone older.
Yeah.
and I think, older, are you sure? And, you know, it's just like constantly like that. So, yeah. As I say, so when I go into an environment where I think, oh my gosh, I feel like the other, then I become very conscious of it. And one of the difficulties it creates is that my relatedness to other people is then filtered. As I was thinking about this interview, I was thinking, in some ways, I've never been on Prozac. Like, people who have been on Prozac, they, you know, it kind of feels like they're in a bubble. They're kind of, you know, interacting with the world, but it's almost like, you know, underwater sound. You can kind of hear things, but it's kind of, you know, not so clear. You're interacting, but it's through a pane of glass that's slightly permeable. And I think sometimes I feel as though I keep my real self within this kind of permeable boundary, and I interact, but there's this bit of me that remains protected, because I know at any time in the conversation, someone could drop a comment in there that is not intentionally designed to be painful, but it will be painful nonetheless.
Yeah, well, as you said, this obviously must be painful. What coping strategies can you develop to sort of at least counteract that?
Yeah, and it's an interesting one, because I sometimes wonder the extent to which my achievements have been driven in part by wishing to disprove stereotypes. And you know, many people from minorities, whatever, you know, whether it's racial or sexual or, you know, religious minorities, often feel, you know, women sometimes kind of, you know, are driven to prove that, you know, they're just as good or better than, and that acts as a motivating factor. And it's kind of good in a way, because they rise to levels that they might have otherwise not have risen to. But then there's obviously the kind of yang side to that yin. But for me, I guess I cope first and foremost by loving myself. It sounds, I don't know if it sounds bizarre,
no,
but I have this real sense of, actually, I need to really love myself. And it's something I've really been passionate about with my son, is, you know, I want for you to love yourself. Not to say I'm perfect and flawless, because that's not what I mean by that. But it's just that, actually, with all my flaws and all that, actually, Harry, you're a lovable guy. You're a good enough guy. And, like, you know, whatever comes at me, I can thrive on knowing that I feel content with myself. And the phrase I used to use a lot is, at the end of the day, I'm the one who has to sleep with myself when I go to bed at night, and to be content with who I am. And that's going to be my priority, that I find some peace in that place.
Yeah.
And then everything flows from that. So there are kind of other strategies I use, you know, like, you know, ensuring that I can move my way through different walks of society. So I can move in the hood and kind of feel comfortable. I can move in the higher echelons of society and be comfortable. I have my strong relationship with my son. And for me, that's probably the most grounding thing in my entire life. And the safest place for me is in that kind of relationship. So there are kind of things about, you know, my own sense of worth and being clear about that, but also forming relationships with people where I kind of feel safe, and there's a kind of neutrality to this fundamental love of who you are. It doesn't mean that we always love what the other does, but it's the kind of who you are is lovable.
Sure, yeah. And I'm not saying it's a given here, Harry, but I think, you know, if you have the ability, or you cultivate the ability to be kind to yourself, I think it's a lot easier to be kinder to others as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, funnily enough, I think that's true. Because when we think about, and I'm kind of very mindful of, you know, the relationship between what I'm talking about with the kind of middle way. And I think, you know, my approach to the field of equality and race inequality is identifying that, yeah, people do get things wrong. And there are some people who, yes, deliberately go out and are intent on being benevolent. But actually, the majority of other people, through clumsiness, through ignorance, kind of stumble into acts that are aggressive, microaggressions, acts that are painful, but kind of come through ignorance. And I don't say that to kind of let people off the hook, to put it in a colloquial term. I say that because that's where my compassion comes from. Because I might look back and think, if someone kind of takes me back to my 17-year-old self and some of the comments I might have made about people who are disabled, or, you know, my sort of 21-year-old self and some of the comments I might have made about women, I don't know that they would have held up. So I recognize that I, too, have been on a journey.
Yeah.
And therefore, I have to kind of, I say have to, that kind of sounds harsh, but I feel compelled to recognize that other people are on a journey. Now, I sometimes think, goodness, I'm surprised that someone at your level in 2015 are still back there with the way you analyze the subject. But even so, I think people have to start somewhere.
I quite agree there, Harry. Do you think, as you say, there's a more general recognition due to all the influences that we've been subjected to, that we all are prejudiced? It's inevitable that we're going to be prejudiced to a lesser or greater degree. But if we acknowledge that, you know, often I think debates get stymied because people are terrified of being called racist or prejudiced. But if there was a recognition there, then we could maybe move forward more.
No, indeed. And, you know, there was a time back when the term, after the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, where the term institutional racism had some currency, and then it became unpopular. And even Trevor Phillips, who was the chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, said, you know, look, I think it's outdated as a concept. And yeah, people no longer use it in public service, or very seldom do. I think we need to be prepared to talk about race and racism and to understand what it means. Because kind of going back to the process of racialization, that kind of concept of difference and the otherness is designed to do something. So I make a simple point. If I say to you that my weekend in Cornwall was beautiful, it was all blue skies, I actually was not describing to you that the sky was blue, literally. Mm. Yeah, the sky perhaps was blue, largely, but you immediately infer that I had a lot of sunshine, it was great, I was eating ice cream, or whatever it was. You know, it was just that kind of lovely, beautiful week that we all want in Cornwall. And when we talk about someone being black, we're not describing a physical pigmentation or characteristic. That's a shorthand. It's a cipher for so many other things.
Sure, yeah.
Some of which are deliberately inferred, and some of which are unconsciously inferred by that. And I think that's really important. So people often say, oh, I'm colorblind. I don't really see you as being black. And that kind of implies that my blackness is like, you know, what my skin looks like. My blackness is very little to do with what my skin looks like. It's to do with the consequences of what my skin looks like. And if you don't see the consequences of what my skin looks like, it means that you kind of overlook the pain that I experience when I experience those microaggressions, when, you know, that incident in Beddington Town Hall, or, you know, many incidents like that, you know, when I, you know, came out from a show with my sons and, you know, we saw the guy behind the till say to his colleague, you know, get the CCTV camera on and watch them. And at the time, you know, it was literally just yards from the department. And I thought, it's funny because you don't know. I walk up and down Pasha's store daily in my pinstripe suit and hat. And if you saw me in the day, you'd think I was, you know, some big shop. And I just happened to be in a leather jacket and my jeans at night with my sons. And for some reason, I become something else. Those things scar a little bit. Now, if you say you don't really see that, it kind of denies that those experiences have value or that they have real ramifications.
Okay, well, could you explain, Harry, what, in relation to this, what is unconscious bias?
Right, yeah, I mean, the kind of process of unconscious bias, first of all, acknowledges the idea of the unconscious. So the unconscious, you know, without kind of getting into it in too technical a way, is that part of us that processes information without us consciously being aware that that's happening, hence it being unconscious. Now, There are many ways in which we, or many things which we process in an unconscious way. You know, we might recognize our route home, and their kind of unconscious analysis of risks if we're driving. You know, it's happening all the time. You know, we slow down. You know, we see a lorry and we think, oh, it might pull out because we're going down a hill or whatever it is, and we adjust how we drive accordingly. And we're not consciously saying to ourselves, oh, lorry, brake. Oh my goodness, a bit of drizzle. We just carry on. Now in life, we have things that are familiar to us that we recognize as being normal. Now we can consciously have that conversation, but actually there is a lower level at which our sense of normality functions. And that's what keeps us safe. That's how we kind of know how to navigate our way through conversations. We know what a normal thing to do is. So, you know, you meet someone at a conference for the first time, it would be quite unusual to just run up and say, oh, yeah, Barry, I've not met before, and plant a kiss on your cheek. It would be kind of, you know, unusual. And these kind of processes that are familiar to us, whereas in different cultures, there are different norms. Now, when people who are different come together, it takes a bit of work for us to accept that your version of normal might be different to my version of normal, and for me to not look down on yours. So if you eat your food with your hands, and I've been taught by my parents, don't eat your food with your hands, it's so uncouth. You know, use your knife and fork, and actually make sure you put them in the right hands and keep your elbows off the table. And that's all this reinforcing of what polite eating is. And if you saw someone eating with their hands, it's going to be very hard for you to not unconsciously feel something's wrong with that, particularly if your parents have said to you, that's so vile, so vulgar. Somewhere, when you see it, this kind of unconscious part of you will probably still hear, like, oh my God, that's still so vile. Now, that's just one example of a kind of cultural difference.
Yeah.
But there are other differences that are associated with stereotypes and attributes. So, you know, the way people look, as I said, you know, blue skies mean something else. A black person means not just that they're black, there are a whole load of other inferences that go along with that. And therefore, if we see someone with authority, where we've been kind of taught to believe that, you know, black people, you know, aren't as good or, you know, can't manage responsibility, then when we see those things, somewhere without us consciously being aware of it, it will trigger these kind of recollections of actually there's a dissonance. And it's only through continuously bringing that stuff up into the conscious that we can undo it, if at all. Otherwise, it just sits there. So the unconscious bias creeps in because often these things are so buried. The last thing I'd say on that, I guess, is because we recognize the unacceptability of that kind of bias, we will push it deeper and deeper down, which makes it less accessible. So it goes back to your point. If we can kind of talk about these things, we could kind of put it on the table and say, I know this sounds really awful, but when I was growing up, my parents would choose to say this, and I'm kind of struggling with it. It gets into the conscious, and we move with it. But actually, because we think it's so dirty and so bad, we push it deeper and deeper, and it becomes so inaccessible, it becomes less subject to change.
So rather than getting suppressed, where you just put it, you know, at the back burner, a lot of this stuff really gets repressed.
It does. But it will find subversive means of escaping.
Oh. It's also pretty socially, I'd say it's pretty socially unacceptable to be openly racist, in the UK at least, by opposing the colour of someone's skin. But there seems to be a lot of elbow room for a sort of proxy cultural racism, whereby we oppose a group's religion, language, clothes, food, etc. In what ways does that concern you, or how does that relate to what we've been talking about?
Well, yeah, there's a famous quote from Margaret Thatcher in 1982 when she said, you know, we in Britain are being concerned about being swamped by other cultures. And I remember many writers at the time pointing out that, you know, the use of culture was a cipher, really, not for, you know, cultures, but kind of other ethnicities and other races. And we do find, you know, the kind of reference to, you know, hardworking people or different cultures and faiths. And, you know, I had a seminar about 6 months ago with English-born Asian man, and he was being interviewed, and he said, "It's interesting because since 9/11, I now describe myself as a Muslim more than I do as an Asian man." And he said, "Actually, in terms of me, nothing's really changed in my makeup or in my the extent to which I follow Islam, but actually, the world seems to have defined me more by my religion, and I therefore kind of describe myself as a Muslim man." And it was kind of interesting because it links back to what I was saying about that process of racialization, that sometimes the identities we carry aren't those that we would choose ourselves. You know, so, you know, a lot of people from, I don't know, black Jamaican backgrounds, you know, end up saying, "Oh, you know, us BME people." Well, actually, BME, black and minority ethnic, isn't a natural language that would emerge from a group of Jamaicans, but it's a term that's kind of conferred upon us. And then, you know, some still would say, "I'm not BME, I'm black, or I'm Jamaican. I don't go for the term BME." But some people will embrace it because it's a kind of doorway, it's currency. So in answer to your question, yes, I think you're right. You know, Patricia Williams in the Reith Lecture in 1987, I think it was, you know, kind of used that phrase about a cipher, that, you know, so many things are a cipher for race. And that's often what happens. So people will say, you know, I'm a bit concerned about the kind of loud noise we might get from those neighbours. And it's like, well, why are you concerned? Have they played any loud music? Have they had loud parties? No. So why are you concerned? And people will say, you know, I'm just concerned. And they can't actually articulate, well, actually, you know, they're a black family and I kind of think they're going to be playing loud music. It's just, well, yeah, I'm just concerned, because they can't articulate it. So often you find those little kind of references, you know, whether it be about being a good dancer or, you know, I expect you'll be kind of good at sport. So I'll give you a good example, a very quick one. My son was going to college, and we were going, because he's interested in wood, is very, very fine at it, I must say, his first year. That's what he wanted to do when he was young. We walked in to the open day. It would have been 2013. And we walked in. There's a welcome gentleman. And he said, "Oh, hello, welcome to our open day. I guess you're looking for the sports course. It's down there to the left." And we said, "No, we're looking for woodwork and joinery." And me and Aaron, we looked at each other and kind of smiled, because we knew exactly what had just happened.
Yeah.
Now, we went back and said to him, "Why did you say?" He would have said, "Oh, because it's tall," or because, you know, he would have come up with an explanation. He wouldn't have said, "Oh, because you're black and I can't think that black people do sport," because that would have been unacceptable. But have you got any kind of ideas why he might have just said that? And it's that kind of thing that happens literally on a daily basis.
Sure, yeah. This sort of aversion to the other, do you think we first get it off our parents, you know, like who is us, who is them, who is to like, who is not to like?
Well, I think earlier on I was kind of talking about our concept of normal, and, you know, when something is unfamiliar to us, how we react to that. And I think, yeah, we get it off our parents, but, you know, in the field of education, if you really get into it, you begin to realise that the greatest teachers of our young people aren't the schools, and they're not just the parents. Actually, the society, the books we give them to read, the things that are in the TV shows if they watch TV, what happens on the street, they're the things that teach our children how to behave. And we teach our children what's normal through so many mechanisms. So, you know, the kind of pink for girls thing is reinforced so, so, so strongly.
Yeah.
You know, I've run that experiment. If you type in girls' toys into Google and do Google images, you will get a lot of pink toys. And you could even get, you know, Power Rangers for girls. You might get pink Power Rangers, because I've not tried that one. But it is literally, you know, that hardwired into our thinking that pink means, you know, girls and blue means boys. So if you wanted to run an experiment and you just said toilet and put a blue dot and a pink dot, it would probably be 100% guaranteed that the guys would go to the Blue Dot, because, and there's so many things like that that is kind of normal for us. So prejudice starts from this process of categorization, and it's an important principle that, you know, when we teach children to understand the world, we get them different colors and we jumble them all up and we say, put the blues together, put the pinks together, you know, put, and we do that and we teach them to cluster. We do that with a fruit, we get them to cluster, we do it with shapes, post it into that little box, and all the time we're saying, draw data of things that look similar and recognize that. That process is the foundation for prejudice, because it tells us first and foremost that you can see something, it looks like something else, and be relatively confident that it fits. So if you're able, through the media, to say there's been a shooting incident, or there's been, you know, whatever incident, and because a black face looks different anyway, if you get that face being not that particular face, but a black face being shown on the television or in the papers sufficiently frequently associated with a particular incident, it's easy for people to then cluster that and say, okay, these kind of crimes are associated with this kind of looking person. And that process doesn't happen consciously necessarily. It happens at an unconscious level. So prejudice is built on this process of categorization. Then the final thing I'd say about it is that we tend to ascribe greater homogeneity to the other group than to the group that we belong to. So we might, if we're a Christian, we might know that there are lots of denominations and understand the kind of real differences in that, but we might say, oh, you know, my friend, they're Hindu, and assume that they're kind of part of this kind of, you know, very unique, not monolithic, but kind of singular kind of group with a lot of homogeneity in it. Whereas Hindu will include this kind of massive variety of ways of being. And it's any in-out group, you get that. So that's kind of one of the processes that happens, is that by saying, okay, you belong to that group, the assumption is you fit all of the kind of beliefs I have about that kind of group. So a lot of people would look at me and guess what kind of music I listen to, if they think that's what kind of being a black guy is listen to. And they may well be right, but they could be wrong.
Okay, well, let's move on now to interrelatedness. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, this idea that we are all connected in some way. So, you know, we could kind of think we're worried about, you know, money being spent on public services because it puts us into deficit, and, you know, what we want is to kind of see more cuts. And then in 5 or 6 years, we'll find more people on the streets begging. You know, we might find, you know, a lot more people doing acquisitive crime. So our children, who might be in their early teenage years, are coming home from being out with friends in the evening, and we're more fearful. And we might then complain about why is it that society's become so bad, you know, because there are all these crooks and fiends out there. But actually, we bought into this concept that we don't believe that public services should provide a safety net for these people, and then we end up reaping what we sow. And it's just the idea that we can't think, oh, well, those people have got problems, it's their problem, because eventually it ends up becoming our problem. So if you're really, like, you know, homophobic, and we create a society that is that kind of violent towards gay people, then you will end up with more people using illicit substances on the streets, you know, being homeless, and you're kind of ending up in destitute situations again. You know, the park that your kids once played in happily, you might find syringes in. On the one hand, you're quite happy to be openly anti-gay. And then one of the kind of consequences is that the kind of internal trauma it causes people leads to these kind of, you know, social problems, which then affects the environment in which you live. So we can't separate, you know, any aspect of ourselves. We can't really separate ourselves from others. So that interrelatedness is about, well, eventually your pain may well become my pain.
So what you're saying there, it obviously has a connotation of integration too, yeah?
Yes. So, you know, the kind of whole idea, for example, that, you know, migrant groups come in, or that, you know, people who are different are finding their way in society and that they're the other, it is a kind of fallacy, because people aren't really the other. You know, we can hate difference, but when we get on the London Underground, you know, it will still be staffed by people who are significantly the other. Or our NHS system is largely built on people who might be the other. So our whole infrastructure, you know, even our cuisine, that, you know, it's changing over time. And that's influenced by the fact that our society is changing. It's got this wonderful mix. Our supermarkets look different now. And for us to say we want to go back to a pure world where, you know, it was all just white people, is, it can't be done, but also it's not desirable.
No.
Because there are so many things that would be lost. And it's that we've become so woven together. You know, the internet, you know, where did that come from? You know, it's like, you know, the ethnicity of people who have done so many major things really has shaped the way we live and breathe. The telephones, the roundabouts on our roads, you know, some of the kind of medical technologies are all by people who are non-white.
Yeah.
Not all, but, you know, many of them are.
Many of them, yeah.
And, yeah, it's just that we can't deny that we're all connected.
Yeah.
And it's somehow we want to scoop up the bits that we like and leave the bits that we don't. And people try and do that in relationships. They really like the kind of weekends when, you know, it's kind of calm and you're sitting reading, yeah, the newspaper, having coffee. But the bits when you're rushing around in the morning and stepping on each other's toes and it's argument, you know, we kind of wish we could not have them, but we can't. It's just like, that is what relationships are like.
Yeah.
That is the way the world is. Difference is going to cause some dissonance. But that's kind of the beauty of us finding growth through that, for me, is what makes us flourish. That's, for me, the essence of our humanity.
That, to me, you're sort of expressing the middle way in a sense, because, you know, in some ways the extremes are easier, they're straightforward, and it's messy in the middle, it's chaotic and complicated, but that's where real stuff and creativity happens, and where we can really learn and flourish together.
No, indeed, indeed. And I think that for us to be comfortable in that place, it needs us to consciously see value in something more than driving the latest BMW or Jaguar, and, you know, having the kind of best possible house you could have, and living in the best possible area. That actually, you know, we do have a philosophy in the West largely of, you know, kind of keep pursuing, be the best you can, this kind of aspirational society. And I'm not saying it's wrong to try and do well at all, but our focus being so predominantly on that degree of aspiration, I think erodes our attention to some of the things that are more important about us as human beings.
Yeah, I think you're right there. Sometimes I think this, partly the economic model, that this, again, this absolute view that we're homo economicus as opposed to we're homo empathicus. You know, I mean, it's not that an important aspect of us isn't self-interest, but it's not the only part. A big part of us is that we're social creatures, and we're built to sort of empathise with each other.
No, indeed. And, you know, I say this with a real genuine humility myself, because I describe things that I'm wrapped up in too. But we would go and have a lovely slap-up meal and then go to a cheap store to get something, to go and get cheap coffee, or the cheapest fruit we can get, and to want to buy, you know, from Primark or whatever it is. And I kind of think, you know, we don't want to spend money, a fair price for things, but actually, you know, we're happy to kind of splash out money on something else. And, you know, I'd love to see a world where we place value on saying, this costs a bit more. I remember back in the day when I used to buy my records, and there was a shop in West Green Road, or on Tottenham High Street as well, where I'd go and buy, I said, I could go to HMV and buy this, but I'll spend my extra 50p and go there, because that shop, they get some specialist records, and even though I could get this one at HMV, they'll have one that HMV will never have. So I'm going to keep buying here, because I want to keep them afloat, because one day they'll go, because no one's going to shop from them. And then we all lose out. Those of us who love that kind of specialist music won't get what we want anymore. And it's that kind of idea that we're so short-sighted to say, I want to save the money, I'll go for the cheapest option, because it's all about keeping our money. Whereas, even though there's some kind of selfishness in, you know, wanting to still be able to get my record, is that idea of seeing beyond today to say, we're all connected, and maybe sometimes spending that little bit of extra money. So that's why buying, you know, fair trade products is a good way of saying, yeah, it might cost me a little bit more, but at least I know, you know, I can share a bit of my money. I'm actually still getting a product. It's not even charity. All I'm doing is paying for something close to the cost of it.
It's just seeing the bigger picture, isn't it? It's the same thing, but, you know, if you eat meat, you buy your meat from an ethically sourced place. You know, okay, it costs a bit more, but then you're making that connection that we're also connected to animals too.
Yes,
you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. To what degree do you think the emphasis on productivity and wealth accumulation confound the issues of integration?
Well, I guess the fundamental model around economic advantage is built on something close to a selfishness, that anything that stands in the way of protecting assets becomes a problem. And therefore, people who maybe new arrivals or who have got a disadvantage because they don't have capital wealth become a problem in a way, because they're holding back our rate of progress. So I kind of think it then creates more opportunities for mischief makers to say, well, these people are getting your housing, or these people are getting your jobs, or these people are just, you know, more of a nuisance. Because actually, look how wealthy we could be, you know, if it wasn't for the others. And that's how I think it affects integration, because it sees a degree of discontentment that actually doesn't need to be there. If all we wanted to do was to just kind of live a happy life, to have people around us who we love, then we'd be content with a lot less. But if all we want is to be able to kind of keep working and to kind of keep getting more and more, then, you know, there's a lot that stands the way of that.
Sure.
And therefore, we're not going to want to integrate and embrace that.
Exactly, yeah, no, it makes sense to me, Harry. Okay, so just to summarise all this, you know, we've talked about certain solutions, but in a global sense, what do we need to do?
I think that last subject we discussed about, you know, what we see our purpose as, I think there needs to be a fundamental review of that as a society to change the nature of the debate about how we measure our success. And it's difficult because we exist in a global community. But, you know, we talk about our GDP and we talk about our economic progress, and there's very little spoken about, you know, other areas of success or failure as a nation. I think we need to change the nature of the debate and move more and more towards a place where we understand our real purpose as human beings, as to, you know, strengthening our relatedness, our connection to other people, and for us to share in each other's growth and to be excited by other people's progress. You know, because, you know, in other settings, that happens. If you're on a course with people over a period of time, you find that, you know, if you're doing something, you become good at it, and then you start to, you almost will someone else to, you know, whether it's playing an instrument or doing something in sport, you will your friends, and you kind of, the person on the course say, oh, brilliant, you can do that now, and you celebrate in their progress. You don't kind of think, oh, well, I was the top of the class and I don't want anyone else to be good. You're excited by that. And it's that kind of, you know, that sense of we belong together. You know, I don't feel happy if I'm the only one who graduates with success. I want the other people around me to be successful. That's the kind of mentality, the kind of spirit, in a way. It's not even a mentality. The spirit of oneness is the kind of starting point. And I don't mean that in a really soft, in a kind of, in a negative way of that kind of softness. I mean that in a real sense of that's how we're strongest. That's what means that the time when we get knocked down, because it's hard for us all to go through life without getting a blow, that means that when we get knocked down, we can kind of feel safe in saying, I'm struggling. And whether for some people it's the benefit system, for others it might be leaning on a family member, but others it might just be their partner. But for us to feel safe in a place where we say, last week, last decade, last quarter of a century, I was up, but this is my time when I'm struggling, and at least I know I can rely on you. That's all we ever want.
Yeah, so it's been able to having that strength to be vulnerable in a sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. You were talking there about things on a social level, but what can we also do on a personal level? You know, we've talked about trying to raise awareness and ignorance and stuff. For example, in the Middle Way Society, practice is very important to us. Do you also have a practice? You know, we're not just a group of people that relies on ideas.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it's funny. I didn't see this one coming. I do. Funnily enough, I was talking to someone the other day, and we were just kind of talking about how we change ourselves. And I was saying, sometimes the change that we look for isn't in the obvious place. So, you know, go walk up a mountain, or you know, take a weekend out and don't be active in it. Just try and find a quiet place and just be comfortable with yourself. Like notice what your fears and anxieties are. You know, that sounds like mindfulness, but that kind of practice is really important to me. So I do something called Five Rhythms Dancing.
Oh, I know, yeah.
And, you know, that's a way of me, you know, dancing a wave. Sometimes they're courses, sometimes they're just sessions. And really trying to find a way of expressing what I feel or feeling what I feel. I mean that, it's not stumbling over words. I mean that deliberately, feeling what I feel in other ways than just trying to think about it, but feeling it through my body, noticing that, you know. Sometimes I do go to Quakers, but for me, I guess mindfulness is, and meditative practice is really important for me. And in that, as I say, noticing what I feel, noticing my fears, but also just noticing nature. I remember being on a Zen course and going through this process, and at the end of it, kind of just looking, I'm looking outside at the trees now, and kind of thinking about, you know, the way I see them just differently after that weekend, and reminding myself that, you know, in my days sometimes, I'll just either go outside or stand and look at the window and just breathe. Literally just breathe and look at the world and think, yeah, I'm connected to this wider world. So that kind of mindfulness is really important to me. Trying to stay grounded.
Yeah, okay, great. And then, what is your understanding of the middle way, Harry, and how might it relate to what we've been talking about today?
You know, I do a lot of work in this field, and people ask me, what are the answers in this field of race and race inequality? What is the answer for this and what is the answer for that? And I say to them, you know, listen, if it were that simple, this would have been solved years ago. And therefore, it tells you we're dealing with something complex. And that complexity isn't something that is confounding and means that we can't resolve it. It means that we need to be prepared to be curious, to understand why it is that people come from the place that they come from. That, you know, that for me as a black man, that white middle class child who went to, you know, a privileged school that interacts with other people who have privilege, who see the world a certain way, who then make assumptions about who I am and what I bring to the world, I have to kind of try and understand that view in order for me to have a connection and a relatedness, and for me to ever hope that they can see the world differently. Now, for me, the middle way is about being prepared to occupy that untidy place where the emotional part of me might wish to turn my back on prejudice and hatred and to feel safe with people who I think are like me and like-minded. But I know that by just staying with like-minded people limits my potential for growth, and it limits the potential for other people's growth. So racial difference brings up a lot of tension, and working with that and not defaulting to easy explanations, either of saying that actually all we need is for black people stick together and solve their problems, or all we need is for, you know, white people to resolve their prejudice and not to look to black people to ever kind of explore their own prejudices. I think they're kind of answers, but they're limited. Because actually, once we live in a world where there are social interactions across racial lines, and bearing in mind, I kind of, given my caveats about how I define race, but, once we got those, we have those interactions across so-called racial lines, I think we then need to provide some mechanism for those to be meaningful, as opposed to adopting positions. If you adopt positions, you end up having to protect those positions,
yeah.
And you then lead yourself away from curiosity about the other, because you start from wishing to protect your position. And like, I really believe that we need to be curious to understand. And for me, that's the middle way, about trying to find something which isn't just about defaulting to set answers, because they might work in 99% of the cases, but sometimes they don't. And it's on those odd occasions we need to kind of find out what is it that's going on.
Okay, great. Great, Harry. Okay, my last question. If people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Well, I have a website, www.hsconsultancy.org.uk. On there, there are blogs, there's a publications section, so people can either download or get to the source of some of the things I've written. My Facebook page, which is HS Consultancy, that's also on Facebook. Yeah, it's kind of more live, which kind of updates people on the work I'm doing currently, and that will also link people to my LinkedIn page, which is Harry Sewell, and it's the one linked to HS Consultancy. And either of those routes, people can find me. My contact details are widely available on either my website or my LinkedIn or Facebook pages, and people are kind of welcome to contact me, ask questions. I'm pretty accessible as a person. I'm often really busy. I can have days and days when I'm just kind of going from one project to the other. So sometimes there's a delay. But actually, I often pick up the random ones, first, because I think, oh, this is interesting. Who's this contacting me? So, the ones that are about, they want a loan from some far place in the kind of rest of the world, I don't answer those ones so much. But if it's a genuine inquiry, please do contact me, email, call, or contact me via the website. Really happy to hear from people.
Okay, great. Oh, well, thank you ever so much for talking to me today, Harry. It's been a real pleasure.
I feel really honoured and I'm really pleased. And, could have spoken for more. There's so much stuff to be spoken about. And, I wanted to say one last thing, I speak about this subject from a real place of wanting to see change. And I know that there are people who won't agree with everything I say, and that's kind of fine. But at the heart of what I say is this desire for us to improve things and to kind of recognize that there are no easy answers, that it just takes us working it out together. And it's that bit that matters to me, the together bit.
Yeah, well, that certainly came across, Harry. Anyway, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Middleway Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.